All eyes on North Korea today.
And the transition to a new leader.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, December 19th.
Coming up, we'll find out more on how the death of Kim Jong-il could change things for North Korea.
And we'll ask if there could be any impact to the economic relationship with the U.S.
Also, Vegas gambles on fancy hotel rooms.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The death of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il has a lot of countries on high alert today. Power is expected to transfer to his youngest son, Kim Jong-un.
The big question is just how smooth or rocky that transition might be. Now, for almost two decades, Kim has kept the country and its economy isolated. Marketplace's David Gura has this economic snapshot of North Korea.
Mike Chinoy is a researcher at USC, and in August, he made his 15th trip to North Korea.
You just get a sense of almost no energy and very little economic activity at all.
The country really has two economies. Scott Snyder of the Council on Foreign Relations says one economy benefits the Kim dynasty, the elites.
The general economy is separate from that, is pretty impoverished.
Hunger is widespread. North Korea is increasingly dependent on food aid. Infrastructure is in disrepair. Under Kim Jong-il, North Korea invested heavily in defense. It has one of the biggest militaries in the world. John Park is with the U.S. Institute of Peace. He says North Korea has economic ties to just a few countries. Two-thirds of its trade is with China.
We see the Chinese facilitating a lot of commercial and economic development activity along the border area,
where there's coal and iron ore. Experts say these next few weeks will be critical. They're looking for signs of change. But Mike Chinoy says not to underestimate the country's political system, which he calls resilient.
The North Korean elite know that if they don't hang together, they could easily hang separately, and they will have strong support from China.
And that may mean more of the same. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
World leaders are watching closely for clues about what the new North Korea will be like.
And really, if it'll change at all. For more, we're joined by Brian Myers, who's a professor of international studies at Dongseo University. He's with us from Busan, South Korea. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, bring us up to date on the current state of North Korea and its economy.
Well, as for its economy seems to be in better shape than it was just a couple of years ago. I was in Pyongyang in North Korea in June, and you could see there was sort of a different atmosphere in the air, a lot of cheerfulness, a lot more foreign cars on the streets, sort of Western-style franchises like hamburger shops and things like that. You generally get the impression of things looking up economically, and the usual reason given for this is that Chinese investment has really increased quite drastically in the past few years in North Korea.
But we're still talking about one of the poorest countries in the world, right?
Yeah, well, you know, of course, Pyongyang is a special case because it's so to speak, the showcase city for the entire republic. But I drove across the country to the eastern coast as well. And I must say, I saw a lot of evidence of malnutrition. You see stunted children. People are generally much, much shorter than their counterparts in South Korea. But I saw no evidence of starvation, and I didn't get the impression from talking to people that you know, any kind of revolt was in the offing. Certainly nothing like that.
What are your main concerns as we go into the next days and weeks and this transition in North Korea?
Well, part of the problem is that Kim Jong-il really has died at a bad time for the North Korean regime, because 2012 was supposed to be a long, nonstop celebration of North Korea's having attained to the status of a strong and prosperous country. And the North Korean economy really just has not fulfilled expectations to that extent. So the danger is that the North Korean regime might want to divert attention from its economic failures by ratcheting up tension with the outside world. And that could mean some kind of provocation, another attack on South Korea, perhaps like we saw in 2010, or perhaps problems on the nuclear front. So it's certainly unstable.
Brian Myers, professor of international studies at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, we also wanted to know if the transition might alter the economic relationship between the U.S. and North Korea.
So we called up Victor Cha. He was President George W. Bush's top advisor on North Korean affairs and is now director of the Asian Studies Program at Georgetown University. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's the current economic relationship between the U.S. and North Korea?
The current economic relationship is really non-existent. The North Koreans have been under sanctions for decades now, and while there have been attempts to loosen sanctions against North Korea, they have not really resulted in any substantive economic cooperation whatsoever. So there really is not much at all that's happened between the two countries economically.
And how could this transition change that relationship?
Well, right now there don't seem to be any prospects for any major change. The only likely scenario under which you'd see major change is if a new leadership were to denuclearize, give up all their nuclear weapons, were to revise human rights policies, and opt for normalization of political relations with the United States. Then you could see a complete rewriting of the relationship. But at this point in time, there are pretty heavy odds against that sort of thing happening.
And so is there anything on the smaller level that might change?
On the economic side, you know, just before news of the death of the North Korean leader, there were negotiations last week over restarting food assistance to North Korea from the United States. There were also working-level discussions about restarting a POW-MIA remains recovery project that the U.S. military was doing in cooperation with the North Korean military. Again, these are very small pieces, and it's unclear whether any of this will move forward until the smoke clears in North Korea with regard to what happens after Kim Jong-il.
Victor Cha is the director of the Asian Studies Program at Georgetown University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Well, in Washington today, the House of Representatives will tackle the issue of whether to extend the payroll tax cut. This is the tax reduction that allowed the average American family to keep about $1,000 extra this year. It was billed as economic stimulus. Well, over the weekend, the Senate gave bipartisan approval to a 2-month extension of the tax cut. But now House Republicans say they're not going to pass that extension and they're going to start work on their own bill. For more, let's bring in our regular Monday guest, Julia Coronado. She is chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
So obviously there are some political calculations going on here, but what's at stake economically?
Well, it's pretty significant economically. I mean, we're talking about 2% of take-home pay for all wage earners in the country. So, in general, we don't think the economy has yet gathered enough steam to withstand that kind of a tax hike. So, it would be pretty meaningful if they don't get this done.
And on the other side of this, though, if they do extend this payroll tax cut, that means that there's less money going into the Social Security Trust Fund, right?
Indeed. I mean, that's the insidious part of this is we are underfunding Social Security with the payroll tax cut, and it's already an underfunded program. So that really makes the longer-term decisions a lot harder.
Well, what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I mean, I think the stakes are so high that they will get something done. The debate has been over how to pay for it, but of course the whole nature of stimulus is you don't necessarily pay for it. You stimulate the economy now and pay for it down the road. It's the latter part that Washington struggles with getting done.
And they have only, until the end of this year to do this?
That's right. If they don't get it done pretty much this week, then everybody sees a 2% tax hike on Jan 1.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
For more on this now, let's hear from somebody actually involved in these negotiations.
That would be Congressman John Carter. He's a Republican member of the Appropriations Committee, and he's with us from Round Rock, Texas. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, are you going to support this 2-month extension of the payroll tax cut that the Senate passed or not?
No, I think we can do better than that. I'd like to see us follow regular order and take a vote on it. I don't expect our members to pass it, and I would assume we'd work towards trying to go to conference with the Senate and come up with a long-term fix, which is what we need to do rather than kick the can down the road.
But if you guys do not approve what the Senate has approved, isn't there a chance that this payroll tax cut just doesn't get extended at all and expires in a couple of weeks?
It's always that chance, but a lot of what you have to do, not only in Congress but in this life, is take the things that come to you when they come to you and deal with them. And I think we've done a little better at it this year, but we've had problems with not facing things head on and kicking things down the road. And American people are looking for solutions.
Well, how important do you think this payroll tax cut is for the economy?
You know, that's a good question. And I'm not sure in the long run it's worth the pain we're going to face when Social Security finally hits its crisis point. But the president chose this route. We agreed to it in order to get the extenders on the Bush tax cuts. And now anything short of passing it would be a tax increase. And, you know, we don't believe in increasing taxes when you're in the middle of a recession. So that's it's kind of a catch-22. We got to get it done.
John Carter is a Republican congressman from Texas, also a member of the Appropriations Committee. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Some Christmastime cheer blowing in for struggling homeowners this week. Due to the still lousy economy, there'll be a halt to many foreclosures and evictions starting today through New Year's. That's thanks to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and major banks, including Wells Fargo, Chase, and Bank of America. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, after the moratorium ends, a wave of foreclosures is expected to break in 2012.
It's hard to knock the biggest lenders in the country cutting desperate homeowners some slack just as folks are gathering around the Christmas tree. But this could turn out to be less than a big deal. First, it'll be over pretty fast.
It's going to be back to business 3 or 4 weeks from now when the holiday season ends.
Guy Sakala publishes Inside Mortgage Finance. He says banks will quickly catch up on the tens of thousands of evictions that they delay. Plus, he says banks are going to restart home seizures now that a big legal settlement over foreclosure abuses is moving forward. The moratorium will help a few who find a miracle on 34th or whatever street they happen to live on. Gail Cunningham of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
You know, if someone could land a job during that period and convince their lender that they have a plan to catch up on their past due payments, then it could be all it takes to stay in that home.
That's not in the cards for Thelma and Eric Caravantes, though. They stopped paying the mortgage on their well-kept bungalow in Portland, Oregon, after Thelma was laid off as a home health aide. With just Eric's minimum wage job at a grocery store, they couldn't keep up, and the bank is foreclosing.
No tengo una comunicación abierta con el banco, pero
Caravantes says he hasn't had any communication from his bank in weeks. He's not sure whether the family's covered by the halt to foreclosures. So his wife and kids are stripping the Christmas tree and boxing up the ornaments, just in case. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, have you ever been in one of those on-again, off-again relationships?
On-again, off-again. I'm sure at some point I have, yes.
Well, economists today are putting up with exactly that sort of hot and cold from consumers worried about their jobs, the overall economy. A report out today from Bankrate.com shows just how jittery consumers are. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ginzer has the sordid details.
The headline on the Bankrate.com report sounds good. Americans' financial security rebounds. Bankrate senior financial analyst Greg McBride is pretty excited.
Americans' feelings of financial security rebounded during the month of November to the highest level we've seen since June.
But the rebound just brings us back to the same level of job security Americans felt a year ago. This is what qualifies as good news these days. Joel Naroff of Naroff Economic Advisors has learned to lower his expectations. He's not getting too excited about a bump up in holiday spending.
While I don't expect the consumers to go out and shop till they drop, if they shop till they're tired, that's pretty good.
But when they wake up with a credit card hangover after New Year's, it's all over, with skittish consumers not willing to commit to spending until the job market gets a lot better. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now to Las Vegas, where Caesars Palace is about to open a new hotel tower with a focus not on gambling, but on fancy rooms.
Would you say they're putting a bet on it, Jeremy?
You just couldn't wait for a Vegas joke, Adrian. All right. Well, Marketplace's Eve Tro says this new focus on fancy rooms as opposed to casinos is a trend in Sin City.
Your room at Caesars Octavius Tower will have marble floors, a pillow-top mattress, a velvet couch, and a whirlpool tub. Why leave all that serene luxury for this?
They're definitely appealing more to non-gamblers, especially the business travelers.
David G. Schwartz heads the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He says Caesars is just the latest company to build a boutique hotel inside a mega resort. Steve Wynn and MGM have done the same. Guests don't have to go through the casino to get to their room, but if they want to play,
you're still only a few hundred feet away from the gaming tables, so it's not like you have to leave completely and go to another property.
It's your own private Vegas away from Vegas. Schwartz says it's a big bet meant to lure the wealthiest customers. That's who hotels are competing most fiercely to get, because high rollers have proven they'll keep coming to Vegas no matter how bad the economy gets. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Well, now to a restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts that just held what it calls Hell Week, which was an ode to spicy food.
Which sounds sort of fun.
It does sound fun, actually. I would be totally down with going to one of these things if I could make it to Cambridge, Massachusetts for next year's Hell Week. But the East Coast Grill is the restaurant that does it, and it offered up a pasta dish so hot, I think they called it the pasta plate from hell, and you have to actually sign a waiver before you eat it.
Wow.
Just to make sure that you know what you're getting into. According to WBZ-TV, one man's reaction was, quote, pain. I can't breathe. I can't talk. It tastes good at first. Now I can't taste anything.
Maybe a little less fun.
Well, Adrian, it seems after 20 years of being the official slogan of MTV during election seasons, the choose or lose is about to get lost.
MTV has announced that for the coming election, the coverage will be called The Power of 12.
In today's Midday Extra, we ask, will MTV's rebranding help bring out the youth voters this time around? And here to talk about that with us is Peter Ubertasio, who's a professor of political science at Stonehill College. Hi, Professor.
Hello.
So is this going to do the trick? Is Power of 12 the hot thing that all the kids are going to just love and go out to the polls and vote as soon as they hear it?
No, I don't think so.
That was sort of resounding.
Well, I think that they have to do something because young voters took choose or lose, I think, at face value last time around. They went to the polls in very high numbers, and they're still very dissatisfied in the way things have turned out. So long as the economy remains number one issue for young people, and at the moment it is, I don't think rebranding by MTV is going to seriously motivate them to turn out.
In the past, has MTV's campaign had an effect on youth voters?
Well, I don't think it has had a dramatic effect, but I certainly think it has fed into a number of efforts that occur to bring young people out to the poll. So it offers people an opportunity for information that is geared toward that particular demographic. And in that sense, it's really quite useful. But I think the Obama campaign did a lot more in 2008 to encourage young people to vote and brought them to the polls than any effort by a media outfit like MTV.
Does it surprise you that Choose or Lose lasted as long as it did?
No, I think that, you know, they put a lot of effort into that. They did quite a lot of good programming and a lot of outreach to political candidates. I think that, you know, you don't want to mess with a brand's success if you don't have to. But all of that happened without the larger context of a seriously bad economy. And in that instance where you have a lot of people turning out to vote, choosing, they feel as if they've made the choice and they're still losing, in which case the brand, I think, is no longer got the appeal that it once had.
And what does MTV have to gain from working on these big campaigns with brands like this? What's in it for MTV?
Viewer loyalty. You know, I think that They get to market themselves as a legitimate news source. They get attention by major political candidates in the two major parties, and that folks who turn into MTV can view it as a place to not only get their entertainment, but also to get news on the side. And the way in which news has become another medium of entertainment, I think it serves their purposes really well.
Peter Ubertasio is a professor of political science at Stonehill College. Professor, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, I've got the most annoying word of 2012. It isn't like, and it's not like, well, you know. No, it's whatever.
Ah.
Yes, that's according to a survey by the Marist Institute for Public Opinion. Whatever they say is like seriously annoying to people, literally. I'm just saying.
Oh, just saying. Now, there's somebody in this very office building that likes to use just saying. I won't name any names.
In Los Angeles, I think that's all I got. Whatever.
Whatever, Adrian. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill. And this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.